The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Food, Sinus, Rhinitis, and Drug Allergy is presented by Dr. Jonathan Horball.
Food allergies. What does an internist need to know about food allergies? No disclosures. Here's our objectives. We're going to figure this all out. So the definition of what is a food sensitization? It's a specific food or a component of a food ingredient, can be haptens, and we're going to talk about that in drug allergies, that's recognized by allergic-specific immune cells and elicited immune response. So essentially, when Dr. Martin and I talk to each other, it's an IgE-mediated reaction to foods, okay? So when we use the word allergy, it's IgE-mediated. Now, there's many, many different types of food issues that you can have that are not IgE-mediated, but when we talk about food hypersensitivity, that's what we're talking about, is an IgE-mediated reaction. So the topics, I tried to figure out where they were going, what they could ask, some kind of off-the-wall questions as to what you need to know from a food position. I think these are the ones that I came up with. So again, an immediate hypersensitivity oral allergy syndrome, eosinophilic esophagitis, delayed anaphylaxis, and food-associated exercise. So I think that's what you need to know. So unfortunately, we got to bring children in here just a little bit just so we can get a basis point from what we're dealing with, but we're going to make it mostly about adults. So food allergy in adults is usually a persistent event that took place in their childhood that's persisted into their adult life. It's very rare for allergies to actually come up in adults, but it can happen. Mostly children, they outgrow them, but they can be persistent. Mainly tree nuts and peanuts are the ones that continue on that you'll see in adults, but adults are mainly seafoods and peanuts in adults. So those are the two that you want to know for them. The severity of allergic reaction to food is multifactorial variable, so it is very unpredictable. It cannot, and this is according to the guidelines, it cannot be elicited on skin prick reactions. So patients come into the office, that we put foods on their back, we look at these big welts on their back and make a decision whether they're allergic or not. You cannot make a decision. So this would actually be an interesting question. You cannot make a decision on how severe the reaction is going to be to the food based upon that test. And the persons that's going to have the biggest issue with food allergy, those asthmatics, okay? So we'll talk about that too. So how do you approach a food patient from an internist perspective? So again, it's always, like Dr. Martin said, you want to take a thorough history. So that's always the first one, first step to approaching this. The second step, according to the expert panel, so the EP guidelines, is performing a skin pressure test or scratch test on their back to identify the foods that might be provoking the IgE-mediated reaction. Okay, so that's the first step that you need to do. Second step is blood testing. So the EP recommends routine measurement. The EP measurement does not recommend, so this can be a distractor, getting an IgE level, so just an IgE level to detect for food allergies. So that is a no-no. So if they say, which of the following do you not want to do, that's one of them. It does not say, it says that you do want to get specific IgE. So that's what the little, is it on here? Yes, right here. So the little S in front of the E there, that's specific, okay? So if you're going to look for an allergy, you want to look for the specific allergy, an IgE mediated to milk or to eggs or to whatever it might be, but a total IgE you do not want to get, okay? So that's important. Again, blood testing it can help you figure out the process, but again, skin prick testing, according to the guidelines, comes before that. The gold standard, so everything is gold standard. So if you want to know the gold standard for food testing and diagnosis, is an oral challenge, okay? So that's something that you want to know. So if they say, what is the gold standard for detecting a food allergy? It's an oral challenge, all right? So then again, that's our last comment down here. Some distractions that you do not want to use. So these are not FDA approved. These are not approved. So these are things that they can put on there to give you a distractor. So which of the following do you not want to do? So patch testing. So food patch testing is not acceptable. IgG food testing, even specific forms, is not acceptable. So I can see them putting specific Ig, specific IgG. You do not pick IgG food testing or intradermal food testing. Do not stick people with needles and inject food underneath their skin. That is not appropriate. There are tons and tons of foods out there. More than 170 foods have been reported in the literature. But we're going to focus on the most common ones. So the incident and prevalence of food allergies increasing over the past 10 to 20 years. Studies of food allergy prevalence are very inconsistent in the literature because of where people eat. So we don't eat the same thing as an Asian culture versus a Middle Eastern culture, so on and so forth. So it's very, very difficult to show, but worldwide is increasing significantly. Common pediatric food allergies, again, I'm sorry, we got to hit kids, but sometimes this comes over into adults. So the most common pediatric food allergies are, again, milk, eggs, peanuts. They rarely have soy, shellfish, grains, and fruits, although that can be there. Okay, but the milk and the egg usually disappear. The vast majority of people, it's the peanut and shellfish that continue on. So if they say, which of the following foods would most likely be common in adults, you're going to pick that. Do not pick peanuts because that's not very common in adults unless it continues, if it's coming from pediatric age group. The LEAP trial. So this is a recent trial. And the reason I'm putting this in here is this is actually a paradigm shift in thinking. I don't know if this is going to be on the boards yet or not, but you guys need to know this because this is an actually paradigm shift in thought processes and in the world of allergy. So this trial demonstrated that you actually introduce, if you introduce foods into kids earlier than later, they will actually become less allergic to them. Okay, so I'm going to let you guys read through this. But essentially, that's what it boils down to. So this is a paradigm shift in terms of thinking. This will be somewhere in your life in the future because of this trial. It's called the LEAP trial. Oral allergy syndrome. So oral allergy syndrome is something they can ask because they're going to want to know whether you're going to give this person an EpiPen or not. Okay, so that they want to know whether there's morbidity, mortality, and all that stuff. So this is something they can ask. So oral allergy syndrome is usually a patient that comes in, you can be any age group, any sex, has some sort of a pollen allergy. So they'll get a runny nose in the season, whatever it might be. They'll have itching and maybe a rash or something come out of their nose. They're going to have itching of the oral cavity. That's 100%. And it's usually something with fruits and vegetables. Okay, it's not usually a protonated food. It's something coming from a bush or a tree. Okay, so apples, melons, peaches, pears, potatoes, celery, so on and so forth. You guys can read. So those are the things. Oops, sorry, went too fast. Sorry. So those are the things that provoke this, okay? They're not going to have any anaphylactic type symptoms. They're not going to have any breathing issues. They're not going to have systemic symptoms or systemic cutaneous symptoms or anything like that. And the test question they're going to ask is, does this person get an EpiPen? The answer is no. The answer is no. So that's a distractor. Do not give this person an EpiPen. They just need to avoid. It's avoidance is essentially the test question answer, okay? Avoidance of the food in question. Or to cook it. So if it says cook it, cook it. If it says avoid it, which is going to say avoid it, it's avoid it. But do not give them an EpiPen. That'll be a distractor. So it'll get down to everything but two. It'll be avoidance and EpiPen if it's avoidance. The next thing, food allergy or food latex food allergy. This is becoming less and less common, but again, board questions like to go back to the times of old. So the issue is that latex food allergy is still a possible test question. It's usually found in people exposed to latex on a regular basis. Okay, so it's healthcare workers, patients undergoing multiple surgeries, spina bifida, so on and so forth. The foods that are associated with this are pitted things again, avocados, cherries, those are the big things. Again, they'll have hives, emesis, failure to thrive as children. They're going to have wheezing issues and so on and so forth. So latex allergy is a pretty strong thing when it goes along with foods. So know that too. Prevention of food allergy. So prevention of food allergy, the EP does not recommend restricting maternal diets or anything like that. So if somebody comes in, if the test question says, you know, something to the fact that mom comes in and asks a question, I don't know if they would do that or not. No, they probably wouldn't do that. But if there's some sort of a question saying, should it be restricted? No, food should not be restricted. All infants should be breastfed. You don't need to know that. Don't change formulas. You guys need to know all that stuff. Hydrolyzed formulas. That's all information, but I don't think it's going to be on there. Eosinophilic esophagitis. So this is possible test question. This is becoming more and more prevalent in the population. I'm seeing more and more and more patients with this disease. The stereotypical presentation or the patient that comes in with this is a 20-year-old male. Okay, so 20-year-old guys are pretty much indestructible, but this is something that they will come in for. So if you see something, a factor of a 20-year-old male coming in with food getting caught and having to go to the emergency room and have it extracted from their esophagus, think eosinophilic esophagitis, okay? Where's the button? Intermittent or daily symptoms, adolescents or adults, failure to thrive in babies, they'll have GERD-like symptomatology. And the important thing in that situation is they continue to have the GERD-like symptomatology after high-dose proton pump inhibitors are administered. So that's important. If they give you a test question where they went into the GI doctor and they had a biopsy done and all of a sudden you're seeing high-powered eosinophils, if they're seeing anything with eosinophils in a biopsy, eosinophilic esophagitis until proven otherwise, okay? Treatment for it is food avoidance. So treatment is food avoidance. I will defer to the gastroenterologist at how to do that. So there's debate whether you want to skin test them or not skin test them or just use empiric diet removals and all that stuff. They're not going to test you on that. They think they just want you to identify the problem, okay? So food avoidance, swallowed steroids are the current treatment. Dilatation is needed of the esophagus and then surveillance. There's essentially no treatment other than that. But if you do see eosinophils in high-powered field with a 20-year-old guy getting stuff caught in there, it's eosinophilic esophagitis. The outdoors guy. Okay, I don't know if this is going to be on there or not, but this is a case. So you have a 31-year-old white male comes to the ED for anaphylaxis. He was seen 4 to 5 times with the same symptomatology this year. He breaks out in hives. He has abdominal pain. He has trouble breathing, wheezing. He was given IV steroids, Benadryl, and also adrenaline that did help in the emergency room. Major hobby is to raise bees. So he's got all these hives all over the face, 5,000 bees, 10 hives all over the back of his very, very grassy, wooded area. Plays a key role, grassy, wooded area that he has to walk into a couple times per week. Very, very avid hunter and likes to eat red meat. And he finds that whenever he eats this red meat, it gets worse. When he eats lean meats, it does not get worse. Okay, so that's all very, very important. So what's the differential in here? What are they going to try to make you think? Food allergy, right? So they're going to say, well, what kind of food allergy is this guy having? They're going to want you to think bees, right? So if somebody gets stung out there and they have an anaphylactic reaction to bees or something like that, that could be there. Some sort of mastocytosis, idiopathic anaphylaxis, some sort of poisoning, malignancy, something out there that's kind of goofy. So they want to know what's going on in this situation. So he goes into the emergency room and he has all this stuff done, right? So CBC is normal, G6PD deficiency is slightly elevated, but essentially normal. TSH is normal, IgE to pork, IgE to beef. Again, the individual components, IgEs to them are normal. Tryptase is elevated, which means there's some sort of an allergic reaction, but then they get this thing called alpha-gal, IgE alpha-gal. It's elevated. Does anybody know about this? No? Yes? No? So alpha-gal, it's a new allergy. I don't know if it's going to be out there. It has been around long enough. So it was discovered in the South by Dr. Deutsch, I guess, in Georgia. So it's a problem with mammalian meat and having anaphylactic episodes. So you have to have been bitten by a tick, okay? So that's why the grassy area becomes important here. So you have to be sensitized by a tick, which then exposes you to this carbohydrate molecule called galactose, alpha-1-3 galactose again, and that sensitizes these people to have red meat anaphylaxis, okay? So again, I'm trying to think of the off weird questions that they might come at you at, and this could be one of them. So you can have an allergy, and this is the reason they're sensitized to it. So what would you do in this situation is have them, you know, avoid, it's down south. You have to be in a tick-infested area, but I don't know if that's all the tick-infested area. We have ticks in Michigan, so the issue is it can be anywhere. But they have to have exposure to ticks. So the answer to the question is wear long pants and so on and so forth if they want to avoid this. It goes away with time, but there is no treatment for it. It's avoidance. Runner's itch. Okay, so 16-year-old female comes to your office after having an anaphylactic reaction, sent to the emergency room department last night. She's done nothing else than normal. So, no, Okay, make her 26 years old. Sorry, an adult. 26-year-old female. It doesn't change the case. She's done nothing different than normal. She's eaten a very light dinner, salad dressing, eaten all these items before, had no issues whatsoever. Recently started to work out, was running on the treadmill. Within 15 minutes of running, she started to have some trouble breathing, progressed, tightness in her chest, broke out in a rash. On her way to the emergency room department, she was getting IV steroids, Benadryl, and told to follow up with you as to what to do. So, went too fast. So, what is this? Is this a food allergy, or what are we talking here? Yeah, everybody looked already. Exercise-induced anaphylaxis, okay? So exercise-induced anaphylaxis, don't tell your patients you can be allergic to exercise, okay? So you can actually be allergic to exercise. But the timing itself and the nature of the situation has to be precise, all right? So usually within 30 minutes of exercise starting, you can eat the food itself and have no issues. You can exercise and have no issues together. But when you put the two things together, you're going to have these anaphylactic type episodes. So this is exercise-induced anaphylaxis. It's cholinergic. You need to know that. But there's debate whether it's cholinergic or not. What else? That's her. That's exercise-induced anaphylaxis. Treatment of food allergies, avoidance and EpiPens. That's essentially the treatment. So at this point in time, there's no FDA-approved modalities for treating food allergies. Just know that. So if they say, well, what do you do to treat this thing? It's avoidance and EpiPens. Okay, so that's important. Case one, I don't know if you want to go through this. So outside of the hospital setting, food allergies, the most common trigger for anaphylaxis in both adults and children. True. There's where it is. Yes, it is. True or false, the results of food-specific IgE skin testing can reliably prick severity of future allergic reactions. False. So it just tells you whether it's there or not. It doesn't tell you the severity of the reaction. True or false, exercising after induction may increase the severity of the reaction. True. We just talked about that. Aspirin, NSAIDs, and other things can do that as well. Patient with a peanut allergy and asthma should be prescribed epinephrine auto-injector. The answer is true. So patients with asthma and food allergies and asthma are at much greater risk of having anaphylactic type events. Yep. What else? True or false? Detailed history. Yes. So always, detailed history can accurately predict patients with atopic dermatitis. That's the key thing. So it cannot predict an atopic dermatitis. Okay. That's all for that one. What's next? Rhinitis, sinusitis. Here we go. So, disclosures. I have none. Here's our objectives. Rhinitis. So, rhinitis category. It can either be allergic or non-allergic, okay, with vasomotor rhinitis, which we're going to talk about in the not-allergic family. The symptoms overlap, okay? So the symptoms start to overlap is why the treatment for them is very, very difficult because it's the same. So allergic, main manifestations of allergic rhinitis are exposed to the thing that has the allergy. Okay, so nasal drip, rhinorrhea, post-nasal drip obstruction, inflammation occurs because of the inflammation of the nasal membranes. Non-allergic rhinitis. So non-allergic rhinitis is a runny nose, but it's non-allergic, right? So you get rid of the perennial and seasonal and triggers that could be causing this up. It's very, very highly diverse group of rhinitis symptomatology. Clear rhinorrhea. Or congestion with less sneezing, less itching, less eye involvement. It's just this constant nasal drainage these people get. So when I was going into my boards, I was approached by the cardiologist. I don't know if there's any here, but I was approached by the cardiology colleagues, and they said, how many questions can you write on a allergy board where the answer is give them Claritin? So This is kind of where they were coming with that. So these ARIA guidelines, this was written a long time ago, back in 2008. The issue is that it's still out there, even though most of the allergy medications are over the counter now. You can get, loratadine or whatever, Flonase, whatever you want over the counter. But the problem is the guidelines still exist, which means it's fair game. That's the problem. So, and there is a rhythm to do this. So it's not just, oh yeah, take some nasal spray, take some pills, and blah, 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 and I'll see you in a bit. No, there's an actual guide. There's a thing that we're going to go through right now to actually do this. So this is fair game. I don't know if it's going to be on there or not. So it was updated in 2008, new classification. So essentially this is the classification scale. So you got choices. You either have intermittent or you have persistent. So this is symptoms less than 4 days a week. symptom duration is less than 4 weeks, and then this is greater than. Okay, so that's the difference between intermittent and persistent, 4 days. Then you have to describe it as they're going to have persistent, mild, or this, or this, or any of this. So you can have intermittent, mild, intermittent, severe, and all this kind of stuff. And these are the symptoms of that. So normal sleep versus abnormal sleep, no impairment in sports, normal work, non-work, troublesome symptoms, so on and so forth. You guys can read that. These are the medications that you have access to. These are the medications you have access to, and the recommendations according to the guidelines to use these or not. So again, this is guideline-based stuff. So they like guideline-based stuff. So first-generation antihistamines are not recommended, okay, because people go to sleep on this stuff. So they said that's not good enough. So second generations, those are what they want you to do. Topical H1 antihistamines, same as oral, rapidly effective. They work pretty good. Intranasal glucocorticoids, recommended for moderate disease, especially with very slow onset. So when they say, you know, I start spraying the Flonase and my nose is not working, that's the reason, because it takes a long time to go. Depot injections that ENTs use, or you give, you know, people shots in the muscle in the office to get rid of this stuff, not recommended. Leukotriene medications are effective or are on the same lines as the H1 inhibitors. Oral decongestants, not good for safety issues long term. Intranasal decongestants, again, the same thing. So those are all the pluses, the minuses. Okay, so we have a case. You're in the middle of the allergy season, just like now. New patient comes out to see you, has been having trouble for 5 to 6 days out of the week. So he's persistent, right? Right. So he's having issues, and he's coming in to see you. So that probably means it's happening a lot. So we can already classify him, right? So having trouble playing soccer outside, having issues with sleeping. He's an engineer, okay? He's an engineer, and he wants to approach this via the guidelines, okay? So he started over-the-counter loratadine, so Claritin, and he wants to know what to do next. So number one, do you change, and this is according to the guidelines, it's not what you need to do, but this is the guidelines. So changes or his H1 medication, sertraline, add on first-generation H1 blocker, send allergy for evaluation, start on nasal corticosteroids, choose B or D, then have him back for an evaluation. So what do you think? C, right? Yeah, no, don't do that. So you guys are supposed to handle every disease known to man according to these boards. So the issue is diagnosed with allergic rhinitis up here, and you go through this thing. So the issue is that here's over here. So here's your mild, here's your moderate, mild, intermittent, persistent symptomatology. You kind of have to go through these guidelines like this, okay? So he was, so for this case itself, he was moderate to severe in terms of, and persistent. So we're kind of down into that orangey box type of thing right there, right? So in the preferred order, okay? So in order to get over to this box, you've had to do this already, okay? So these are bi-mouth antihistamines, okay? So they don't care which type it is or what brand it is or whatever it is, that's all they want you to do, okay? And then you wanna start adding on inhaled steroids or leukotriene modifiers. So that's the order. I don't know if they're gonna ask you that, but that's the order you add these things on, is according to this chart. And then you ramp up, like everything in allergy and asthma, just like we talked about, okay? Again, avoidance. This is part of the guidelines, so you guys have to know this. It's avoidance. So if that ever comes up on the test, it's avoidance, environmental changes, whatever it is, that's the first thing that you always do. And then if you can add on oral, whatever, so just follow this. This is the guidelines you need to follow. Jackie, so another parameter in the allergy world got updated as well. I don't think we're going to spend too much time on it because it's not as useful as the other one that we just did. But allergic rhinitis, you can have seasonal or perennial. Again, hay fever, the difference between seasonal and perennial. Again, here's the treatment algorithm. Again, using those, the other chart before, because that's the way you want to add these medications on. Okay, but it's essentially the same kind of thing, but then once you get into the middle of this chart, that's when you start adding those medications on. So I don't know if I'd memorize this one, but I'd memorize the other one. Okay, are these useful? Seasonal allergic rhinitis, perennial allergic rhinitis, useful, non-useful, you guys can go through that, but the issue that I want to pull out here is this, and I don't know if they're going to test this or not, but the problem is that asthma and allergies are intertwined in each other, okay? So this was a study done from 2008, so it showed that, you know, even in the, you know, people with allergic rhinitis, their asthma gets worse, okay? So follow-up over time is a pretty good study. Shots and all the interventions you do prevent asthma, so I think that's pretty important to understand. non-allergic rhinitis. So, case two. So, we just talked about allergic. This is non-allergic. 81-year-old, right? Old person. Very important in this case. Old person. Comes to the office, she thinks she's starting to have allergy-like symptomatology. She's never been allergic to anything else in her life. She's been watching her grand dog over the past week. While her family went on vacation to the Bahamas, she was starting on omeprazole for some GERD. I'll take the medication just before she eats lunch. She only has clear discharge. Again, clear discharge, old person. Seems to be worse with eating. Okay. She wants to know what's going on, if she's allergic to the dog or what medication. So what are you going to do? It's the dog. Don't dog sit again. It's the medication that she was told just to take before she did the lunch. She needs to be referred to allergy for formal testing. She is not allergic rhinitis, and she needs it. I give up. I don't know. I'm going on vacation. So what do you think? What do you think? Yes, yes. D. Right? So, old person comes into your office or old person comes into this test, they have clear runny nose, never had allergies before, it's not allergic, okay? It's clear. She's not sneezing, she's not itching, okay? That would be more the dog type of symptomatology, but an 81-year-old isn't gonna get a dog allergy like that. So, it's non-allergic rhinitis, drug-induced, gustatory, hormonal, infectious, nares type symptom, which we're gonna talk about, occupational and vasomotor, we're not gonna get through all these. In the elderly, there's three types of non-allergic rhinitis in older patients, okay? So first, vasomotor rhinitis thought to be caused by increasing cholinergic activity, okay? So cholinergic, adrenergic down here, so that's a differentiating factor right there that can help or they can test on. Second type is gustatory rhinitis. When old people eat, they get runny noses. This watery rhinorrhea she's experiencing, that's essentially what this thing is. It's called gustatory rhinitis. That couldn't be a test question. Third, rise from allergenergics, hypertensive medications that you put people on. The treatment for this is ipratropium bromide. Okay, so ipratropium bromide. But the big thing that you need to know about ipratropium bromide is you cannot use this in people with glaucoma. Okay, so they're going to throw this thing in front of you. You're going to say, they don't want to know. They're going to make you figure this thing out. And they're going to say, they're going to make you take two steps. So they're going to give you the answer to the thing, and they're going to make you come to the conclusion it's gustatory rhinitis. They're going to say, okay, we should put them on ipratropium bromide. And then the question is going to be, which of the following diseases cannot be used with the treatment medication? That's the question I would write. Because you got to make you ask three questions in one question. Okay? So glaucoma, don't treat it. Nares. So nares or eosinophilic rhinitis accounts for 20% of diagnosis. Some researchers believe might be causes of an aspirin cascade. So this is Samter's triad. So everybody knows Samter's triad, right? That's a potential test question. So that's aspirin, asthma, and polyps. Aspirin, asthma, and polyps. Very important triad to know. Abnormal prostaglandin metabolism. Eosinophil counts are elevated. You can read the rest of that. Okay, non-allergic. Now the treatment for this stuff, how do you treat it? Anything, you kind of throw anything at it, okay? But what you want to know is the ipratropium bromide. But you can use topical antihistamines, topical corticosteroids, medications called Cromolyn. So you can use the old medications, topical anticholinergics, that's what you want to use. Oral antihistamines, topical, all that kind of stuff. So that's the treatment. Sinusitis. Okay, so sinusitis. So these are infectious disease criteria. So this is last group of things, but this is what you got to know. And this is common stuff. This is which of the following you can't use. So 43-year-old male comes into your office having complaints of a sinus infection. It's all the typical type of symptomatology, right? Headache, facial pain, mucus production, been going on for over 3 weeks, okay? So he's got this. No medication, there's no medication that this could be viral. So number one, what is the antibiotic for your first line treatment? So you got an adult coming in for a sinus infection. What is the first line of treatment? Somebody's saying, and I heard it, C, right? Augmentin, according to the guidelines. Okay, but they're not going to ask that because it's way too easy. So they're going to say, this person has a penicillin allergy. What is the next line of treatment? Somebody just said it, doxy, right? In this category, you can do it. What's the, it's doxycycline. I shouldn't have put Levaquin in there because you can technically get Levaquin too. But it's doxycycline from this standpoint. Identify patients with acute bacterial virus versus 10 days. Okay, so that's what you gotta know. So if they're having symptoms for more than 10 days, it's defined as bacterial. Under that, it's viral, don't treat. okay? And you guys can read all that stuff. Microbacteria, we just talked about this. So, amoxicillin and clavulanic acid is preferred over amoxicillin alone. Let's see what else. High dose. Those are all the people that should be given it. So immunocompromised, hospitalized, all that kind of stuff that you guys should know. So if they're in sick areas, so on and so forth. So over fluoroquinolone. Because high rate of resistance, don't use macrolides, don't use Bactrim, don't use any or TBA, any of that stuff. Anyways, doxycycline is an acceptable alternative for the Augmentin. Second generations, you guys can read that. So adult, again, doxycycline or respiratory fluoroquinolone is used in empiric therapy. So they won't give those both. So that's a bad question from my part. Sorry. But it's doxycycline I would go with because that's the one nobody's going to know because everybody uses Eliquin. So children, you don't need to know that. Duration of treatment. So that's the other thing you need to know is duration of treatment. So it's 5 to 7 days in adults, and that's the kid dosage. Okay, this is for you guys to go through. Patients with non-allergic or non-responsive symptoms, what are you going to do with these people? Okay, so direct sinus aspirate is preferred. Unfortunately, you can't do that as an internist. You're going to have to send them like ENT, so I would get an ENT involved to get cultures. Okay, so you got to know that stuff. Imaging, when is imaging required? When referred to specialist, serious illness, immunocompromised patients, condition is worsening, so on and so forth. So this is a chart directly from an internet website up to date. Everybody always uses, so that's that thing. Chronic rhinosinusitis. Chronic rhinosinusitis broadly defines inflammation for the last more than 12 weeks, more precisely heterogeneous group, blah, 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 blah. Clinical manifestations. Signs and symptoms. So, anterior postnasal mucopurulent drainage, nasal obstruction, blockage, facial pains, all this stuff, lack of sense of smell, so on and so forth. Danger signs, okay? So these are the signs that you want to know, okay? This is when they need help now. So high fever, double vision, proptosis, so on and so forth. You guys can read all that stuff. Specific subtypes. So there's three separate subtypes. So chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps, that's about a third of the population. Allergic fungal rhinosinusitis, about 12%, and without polyps. Okay, so we gotta go through that. Allergic rhinosinusitis, so nasal polyps. So characterized by bilateral nasal polyps and bilabiatus, but nasal polyps translucent. There's a picture coming up next, grayish white type of a mass. Nasal polyps lack sensation. I don't know if that's important or not, but it might be. Unilateral polyps, relatively uncommon, but if you see this, you got to start thinking of bad things, okay? So papillomas, nasal tumors, things like that. So if they say it's unilateral, you were thinking tumors, right? So that's a nasal polyp. Got it? Samter's triads, this is what we talked about before. Okay, so Samter's triad is important. I don't know if it's that important that you guys have to review it, but there is a pathway associated with it. That they can ask if this gets blocked, what goes up in terms of the molecules and things like that. So it could be fair game. I might look that over. Subset of populations, NSAIDs, they have problems with NSAIDs. You guys can read all this good stuff, reactions, blah, blah, blah. CRS with nasal polyposis interventions. Glucocorticoids is the treatment, so surgical intervention is as minimal as possible, and glucocorticoids is intervention. And antibiotics, sorry. Allergic fungal rhinosinusitis. Okay, so this is another one. So this is something that can come out of left field because you don't see it that often, so that's always good primer for board. So allergic fungal sinusitis, been reported. It's mostly people in the south, okay? So you get this thing and they have all the sinusitis stuff coming out of there, all kinds of business. But when you culture the stuff, you get hyphae out, okay? So if you get hyphae out, it's allergic fungal rhinosinusitis. The treatment is controversial and doesn't work too well, but it's ENT involvement, so you need a surgical involvement when that happens. Eosinophilic mucin rhinosinusitis, this is the equivalent to allergic fungal sinusitis, but you see it other places, so there's no hyphae involved. It's just the same thing. It's this mucin thing in the nose, but hyphae are not present in this situation. Again, ENT involvement in this one, so that's you got to call in a surgeon. You don't need to know that. Risk factors. Everybody can read this. So allergic rhinitis, asthma, depression, smoking, immunodeficiencies. Yeah, that's another. Yeah, so if you see polyps, think immunodeficiencies like Martin was talking about. Treatment can't be cured, but can be controlled. Normal saline, surfactants to disrupt things, oral glucocorticoids, intranasal glucocorticoids are not spurious. That's good. Refractory cases, you want to use flagyl. It's really only if they lose smell. Pseudomonas. Oh, this is the one too. So CRS was Pseudomonas. So this is a possible question because it's not this. So ertapenem doesn't have pseudomonal activity. So they can ask which of the following would you treat these patients with? Ertapenem doesn't have pseudomonal activity. So don't pick that one. All right, hold on. One more. Here we go. This one was extremely difficult to figure out because it just was. I don't know exactly what they're going to test you on in terms of an actual drug allergy, but I think what they want you guys to know out of this is, oh, here's all this stuff. What they want you to know is the Gell-Coombs reactions, okay? So these are notorious. They come up every single year. There will be probably a question on this. I think this is what they want me to talk to you about. So Gell-Coombs classification. So there's type 1 through 4, immediate, antibody-dependent, immune complex, cell-mediated, or delayed, right? So 23-year-old guy comes in to see you after camping over the weekend. He was out in the woods. Now he has a rash. It's very itchy. Came up about 3 days after a trip. Lesions consist of small yellow blisters that are swelling. Very itchy. There's nobody else that is affected in the group. What type of hypersensitivity is he having? I have seen this before. I guarantee you I've seen this before. Four, right? Four. And this exact set of foils was on there, okay? So they said type 5 hypersensitivity, so that's immediately you can get rid of, right? There's only four. There's only four in your world. So don't pick 5. But the answer to this one is D. The answer to this one is D, okay? We'll talk about it in a second. That's just to get us started. We're going to start with a type 1. That was not a type 1 that we're talking about. Type 1 is immediate or anaphylactic, okay? So this is an allergic reaction provoked by a specific antigen. So it's an IgE-mediated reaction to something. The release of histamine, tryptase, arachidonic acid by mast cells are all present in this. Inhalation, injection, indigestion, all this stuff can provoke this type of reaction. Happens within seconds to minutes, okay? Timing is key in these questions, okay? So if they give you time, they essentially give you the answer to the question, okay? When you're dealing with type 1 hypersensitivity, it's seconds to minutes. What is the treatment for this? Dr. Martin is going to go into this because I saw some of his slides. He's going to go into why that's important right there. Type 2, antibody dependent. Type 2 is antibody dependent. Antibodies produced by the patient's immune system binds to the cell surface. Essentially, the blood is the medium, okay? That's the big difference between type 2 and type 3, but the blood, it happens in the blood. Antigens are specific. They cause all these kinds of infections. IgE-mediated reactions, hours to days, okay? Hours to days, that's the key in this thing. So a patient comes in and they have all these problems a couple days after starting a medication or something like that, type 2 hypersensitivity. Now the issue is that there are lists out there. This is an abbreviated list, but there are lists out there, and I would strongly recommend that you review these, okay? It is always out there. What's a type this reaction? How is this presenting? Things like that. So autoimmune hemolytic anemia, immune thrombocytopenia, and transfusion reactions are ones that they like, and I will show you why they like those. But essentially, those are the big three, but all those other ones can be an example of a type 2. Type 3, immune complex. So these are soluble immune complexes that form aggregates and are deposited in tissues across the body. Tissue is the medium in this situation, usually affects the skin, the kidneys, and the joints. Hours to days to even longer than that to develop. Example, immune complex glomerulonephritis, and they love serum sickness. Okay, I don't know why, but they love serum sickness, okay? So that's important. But again, know what some prime examples of type 3 reactions are because that's always on there. Again, type 4, so this is the case that we talked about. So type hypersensitivity, 2 to 3 days plus, okay? So we're talking long, long ways out after the actual reaction happened. This is not antibody mediated. So if they ask you what type of hypersensitivity reaction is not antibody dependent, it's type 4, okay? Poison ivy rash. I have seen that before, personally, okay? So you gotta know that one. Those other ones, important, but that's the one you wanna know about. Again, transplant rejection like they just talked about. Whoever's writing boards, he, she, whatever it is a picture of their loved one, a picture of their boat, and then a picture of this thing sitting on their table. They love this diagram, okay? So this diagram or something like it, it always comes up. And the reason it always comes up is because of this stuff down here at the bottom, this stuff. Okay, so they love those things, okay? So please look at this chart and understand this before you go in because this is easy points. Drug reactions. Stratification according to the chemical nature. So there's direct haptenization. There's haptenization of of drugs. I don't know if this is important or not, but this is kind of how everything happens. So it happens with these small separable parts of antigen that react specifically with the antibodies, but is incapable of causing the stimulant or the reaction to happen. So essentially, it's a lock and a key. It's actually two locks and a key. So you need to have these two things in order and together in order for this to happen. Direct haptenization, beta-lactam antibiotics. Haptenization by drug metabolites, sulfonamides are an example, and then complete antigen, so the actual moiety that's causing the reaction itself is, an example is insulin. This is a diagram of haptenization. Again, you need this kind of the double edge, or you need these two things reacting together in order for this reaction to actually occur. How you want to approach drug allergies? You want to look at the diagnosis itself, the history, skin testing, in vitro testing, and challenges. That's the actual gold standard is challenges. The history. So what do you want to know? The nature of the reaction. So what kind of an allergic reaction is there? Again, what type of hypersensitivity? That's what they're going to go after. They're not going to test and say, is this a reaction to penicillin? Is this a sulfa reaction? It's not, because they can't pull those apart enough. What they can test you is which type of hypersensitivity reaction they are. Temporal sequence. So what happened first? When did what go first? When did the itching start? When did the rash come up? Again, timing of these reactions is very, very key. Propensity of the reaction, the propensity of the exposure to cause the reaction. If you discontinue, does the effect continue? Readministration, again, the challenge, does it come up or does it not come up? Onset of reactions, again, you should know something like this, the onset of hours and where the hypersensitivity reactions actually sit. Anaphylactoid reactions. Okay, so the anaphylactoid reactions, you got to know what an anaphylactoid reaction is. This is a non-IG mediated reaction that causes a kind of IG looking situation. The big ones in this is one of the big ones is vancomycin. I put it in red because Redman syndrome, right? Good, perfect. So you got to know that. So that's not an allergy. It's an intolerance to the medication. Opioids, NSAIDs, IV dyes. So that's important. You got to know the difference between the two. Metabolites of drugs. Okay, so metabolites, you got to go back and you got to understand what common drugs have common issues. Okay, so there's certain drugs they love to test on because of the side effects of the issue. Okay, those are extremely important things. I don't think it's going to be a drug allergy they're going to test you on. They're going to test you of what the side effects of these medications are. So G6PD deficiencies and what molecules affect those. Very important. So again, down here in this corner. So chloroquine and primaquine and all these things down here, those are important things to know because that's what they like to treat. Immunodiagnostic testing. So IG medications. So whether you want to test for an immediate hypersensitivity reaction versus a delayed, again, skin testing to test for immediate hypersensitivities, patch testing to test for delayed hypersensitivities, kind of like this. So 27-year-old insulin-dependent diabetic man has done well over the insulin for the past few years. He's been, for the past week, he's had general urticaria immediately after injection of his NPH insulin. Urticaria would need to be gone before his next injection. So what type of hypersensitivity is this, and how would you test for it? So that's a two-for-one type of thing. They like that. So what do you think? So I will tell you, I put A on there as a distractor because you're going to say, oh, type 1 right there, boom, done. So but you don't do type 1 with patch testing. It doesn't work. Okay, so don't fall for that. So type 3 with intradermal testing, that doesn't make sense, blah, blah, blah. The answer is D. So it's type 1 with intradermal skin testing, okay? That's what you want to look for in these issues. If he's having hives right after he's administering the thing, you're looking for a hypersensitive type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. So kind of know what you test for and where you test these things for. This is urticaria. Everybody's seen this before. Those are hives. They move around. Okay, so case 3. This is kind of what I put it. I'm almost done. So 32-year-old man develops generalized urticaria, periodic flushing, systemic rash, wheezing. 1 week after surgical procedure, he's been having itching systemic along with fatigue. He was in semi-good health, but dealing with diet control, diabetes mellitus. No history of asthma or anything. He's there to get his hernia fixed, blah, 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 blah. He and his surgeon want to know what the heck happened. Okay, so how do you approach the case? What's the first thing you do? Get records. Remember, get a detailed history. Okay, so obtain the anesthesiology record, get hospital records, compile list exposures. Don't forget about latex allergies still in hospitals that can be there too. Okay, so there was no documentation of any rash or abnormal vital signs during the start of the surgery. Records show that iodine was used to prep the area. So that could have done it, right? He was just given a dose of cephalexin for just after he had the surgery. So that could be an issue. He did have some hypertension during the case. He was given hydralazine. No latex was used. Okay, so latex is gone. So did develop a rash in the post-op area. Was given Benadryl and it resolved. So what are you going to do? So you've already gotten the history of the patient. What next? Follow the here. Labs. So you want to look at labs. So CBC is normal. CMP just shows elevated glucose, creatinine, but nothing really abnormal. Okay, so all his labs are normal. So what do you want to do? Chest x-ray? Doesn't make sense, right? Skin culture of the wound? Does he have an infection? Doesn't really sound like it. Monitor? It's always a tough one to pick. Order immune labs? Treat with steroids. Right? So don't ever treat stuff unless you absolutely 100% know what's going on the boards, right? You want to diagnose these things. That's what they're trying to figure out. They're trying to figure out if you can work problems up. So don't ever treat. So treatment of steroids out. Chest x-ray, that doesn't make any sense. Skin wound, this doesn't seem infectious, right? Doesn't seem that. So monitor or immune labs? That's right. Let's order some immune labs. So ANCA is elevated. Antihistones are elevated. SED rate's elevated. So what type of hypersensitivity is this reaction is this man having? E? Yeah? No. Never five. Right? So if we go back, and I apologize, I forgot to add this slide in there. It was late. But the issue is that what I'm trying to go after this with this guy is it's probably hydralazine. Okay? So it's the lupus-like syndrome. Okay? So not all drug reactions are allergies. You have to know the side effects of medications themselves. So if you see a patient that comes in, their CBCs are normal, and their CMPs are normal, and so on and so forth, and you draw these labs, it could be lupus-like symptomatology, and that's a classic thing. Where did it go? Go back. Hydralazine. Okay? So the distractors here are the iodine. So they want you to think, oh, they put something on the skin, he's having a reaction. Oh, well, it's not that because, oh, he's having an allergic reaction from the antibiotic. It's not that. You want to know those drug reactions. It's very, very important. There's definitely charts out there for that. We're not going to go through this, but beta-lactam drugs, maculopapular rashes, that's good. Fourth case, this is my last one. So 26-year-old man admitted to the hospital, chief complaint of having a bad rash after he started to carbamazepine. Again, it's the exact same thing we just talked about. You've got to know these big side effects. So these are the antipsychotic medications. What type of drug reaction is this, and what are you going to do? So what is this little guy having, or man having? If you see a rash that looks like that, where skin's falling off and there's bleeding and there's all kinds of stuff, Stephen Johnson's, right? So now I got to figure out, Stephen Johnson's treated with IVIG or is it treated with cyclosporin or something? It's D. So cyclosporin, okay? So Stephen Johnson syndrome, so you got to know the anticonvulsives, okay? So the anticonvulsive medication is very important. I think that can be a very good test question. Anticonvulsive medications and Stephen Johnson syndrome makes sense. Apoptosis lesions, mediated response to the medicines. Cyclosporin is the treatment, but of course, get dermatology, but you guys are supposed to treat all these diseases completely by yourself, so it's cyclosporin. What was the other thing, too? Oh, I just thought of this while I was sitting back there. So what is the number one cause of swelling of angioedema? That's another one of these things. What's that? Do you think they're going to give you ACE inhibitors? It's way too easy. So it's the second one. What's the second one? NSAIDs. Perfect. Good. So you guys got to know that stuff. So it's never the first one. It's always the second one, right? So NSAIDs. Know that. IVIG is not important. Management, avoidance, desensitization, referral to allergy. If you want to desensitize, acute desensitization, I'm way over my time. Conclusions, drug allergy, very, very difficult, but if you know the drugs that have the very, very common reactions, and there are charts out there, I promise you, know those, and that will get you through drug allergy.